Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. We have some interviews, but you have to check the website. I don't like to take time away from the content that we're trying to provide you. I know we've probably been going through the ratification debates for probably about 3 weeks now, and we're almost done. Almost. We still probably have another week or more easily to do because we're still in the middle of the Virginia ratification debates. There is that much meat that we have to go through. The reason why is because the Virginia ratification debates is where you will find the shutting down of this concept of the corporations, this unconstitutional house of cards that Britain and the federal government or general government back after the Civil War had created unconstitutional entities. And as a matter of fact, it was perpetuated upon the states and other forms of government. But it is all unconstitutional. And we'll get into that because the whole premise under this establishment of corporations is based upon martial law. I'm here to tell you that martial law was predicated upon the deployment, only the deployment of the militia, and that only the militia was to be used, that a standing army was not to be used within the United States. It's different in creating a standing army to fight abroad, but not within the United States, because the Constitution clearly dictated that the laws of the Union would be exercised by the militia. So when they try to exercise unconstitutional law, they failed. Therefore, they had to violate the Constitution in the Civil War by creating a standing army, and they did it without amending the Constitution, which is why we have so many problems today, my friends, because they've been operating outside the framework of the Constitution. As you know, the show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. And let me put a little plug in. Reclaiming the Republic is a trademark statement. It's trademarked because we don't want people to start mixing what we stand for and what they're trying to do to put their position into. We're just going to call this market space. I actually look at what most everybody is doing is like evangelical work regarding the conservatism, patriot movement, and so forth. The problem is when you have these evangelicals that center themselves upon money, because then they're following their own hearts and their own desires and their own intent. If they are true patriots, they'll be just like the framers, and what they'll be doing is they'll be putting aside their differences and they'll be putting aside their self-interests. Anybody that is out to try to get rich off of you and everybody else, give us your support and start creating, I'll just call it emoluments because that's what they call it in the Constitution. Anybody that is using this as their primary source of income in supporting their family, it's the same thing as the evangelical church. The awakening, and most churches got in sync with the evangelical church. And I'll even say got in sync with the Catholic church, because it was the Catholic church that made religion a profession. And so in America, the first awakening and up until the second awakening, Christianity was done by, it was a layman's church. You were a way leader in your local area, and then there were, those things you did to provide for your family. John Adams' father was a way leader for his community in the church, and he was also a cobbler. And he made enough money to be able to send John Adams off to go to, I want to say, Harvard, so that he could become a lawyer. And that's the rest of the story. But it wasn't until later in the 1820s, 1830s, where evangelicalism changed and I'll just say perverted the Christian form of the Christian form of religion, because it made religion a profession. And so with that, let me also basically give you the gist that this is still the show that gives you the academic evidence and the evidence, academic evidence-based solutions in resolving our constitutional crisis and problem. So the question I have is, are you a part of the problem? If you are not engaged in the only solution, and I'm telling you, if you can find another solution other than Republic Review in getting the states to actually stand up and audit their contract against the general government and say, where did we give you the power? We don't care what you do on, you know, scribblings and drivel on your own pages. What we care about are the powers that we acknowledged and delegated to you with this here Constitution. Not the Constitution that they're using or claiming to use. So the problem is, are you engaged in that solution or are you engaged in something else? Because if you're engaged in something else or nothing at all, you happen to be a part of the problem. Remember, it was Edmund Burke, and I'm going to paraphrase, that the only thing it requires for evil to succeed is for good men to do nothing. We also definitely want to help you tune into this concept of growing our listenership. Get more and more people to listen. There's no doubt in my mind that as they hear all of these different recounting of the ratification debates and the founding documents, we'll go through a lot more than just the ratification debates. But I want you to know that the ratification debates are the terms of the Constitution. It's the terms, clarifications, and definitions of what that Constitution means. So please help grow this message and help expand this show by helping other people tune in or at least send them to our podcast page. And that's where you'll find out what we're doing next and what we're going to pull out of the hat. May not be a rabbit next time. It may be the elephant itself. But anyway, one other thing I do want to do, because I don't do this enough, but I want to help raise the consciousness of your community on the Constitution. Why are you not asking local businesses to do something for Constitution Day? Now, we've got a lot of great interviews, and oh, by the way, I will be posting today. Today, I will be posting at the end of the day another update from Mitchell Nicholas Gerber regarding, you know, what the heck's going on. And so we'll be posting that for you, and we'll be putting it in tomorrow's broadcast. But the listen line number, so if people say, oh, well, I can't tune in, let them know that they can use the listen line if they can't stream. And the listen line number is 605-562-4209. Excuse me. It is also on our website on reclaimingtherepublic.org, as well as they can also, if they do stream or tune in, they can go to TuneIn. They can go to Red State Talk Radio to tune in. There are a lot of different resources of ways you can tune in, but my podcasts are all available up on reclaimingtherepublic.org. So with that, let us dive into the Virginia ratification debates. And these are really, really, I'll just say, are exposing just due to the fact of this one comment. And let me get through this first paragraph, because the last sentence of this paragraph really nails it. The subject of direct taxation, this is Madison, by the way, this is James Madison on Wednesday, June 11th. The subject of direct taxation is perhaps one of the most important that can possibly engage our attention or that can be involved in the discussion of this question. If it be to be judged, and it, again, when I read typos, it helps me stumble a little bit. If it be to be judged by the comments made upon it by the opposers and favors of the proposed system, it requires a most clear and critical investigation. The objects against the exercise of this power by the general government, as far as I am able to comprehend them, are founded upon supposition of it being unnecessary, impractical, unsafe, and accumulative of expense. I shall therefore consider first how far it may be necessary, second, how far it may be practical, and third, how far it may be safe, as well as the respect of the public liberty at large as to the legislatures, and fourth, with respect to the economy. First, then, is it necessary? I must acknowledge that I concur in opinion with those gentlemen who told you that this branch of revenue was essential, the direct taxation, to the salvation of the Union. It appears to me necessary in order to secure that punctuality which is necessary in revenue matters. Without punctuality, individuals will give it no confidence, without which it cannot get resources. Excuse me. I beg gentlemen to consider the situation of this country. If unhappily the government were to be deprived of this power, let us suppose for a moment that one of those powers which may be unfriendly to us should take advantage of our weakness, which they will be more readily to do when they know the want of this resource in our government. Suppose it should attack us. He's talking about foreign governments, by the way. What forces could we oppose to it? Now, because we're coming at a hard break, I am going to start back off again with, I beg the gentleman to consider the situation of this country. Because when we come back, I am going to give you that last sentence of this paragraph that really galvanizes everything I've been telling you. We will be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, so I won't have to rush now because I know a break isn't just around the corner. So I'll do a little editorializing on the last part of this paragraph. I beg gentlemen to consider the situation of this country. If, unhappily, the government were to be deprived of this power, the ability to tax for being able to support the militia, being able to support the established Navy and Marine Corps, as well as the other things that the federal government is supposed to do, then he said this: let us suppose for a moment that one of those powers which may be unfriendly to us should take advantage of our weakness. He is talking very specifically of Britain, Spain, and other countries and powers that have already exercised harassments and other powers against the United States. And even France is starting to change their tune because we've not been able to pay our debt. And Holland is looking over at us and going, what the heck is going on with this little country called America? Anyway, he says, which they will be more ready to do when they know the want of this resource in our government. Suppose it should attack us, any of these forces or all of these forces. What forces could we oppose to it? Could we find safety in such forces as we could call out? Could we call forth a sufficient number, either by drought or drafting, by, you know, compelling people to come and serve their country, or any other way to repel a powerful enemy? Here's the final sentence. The inability of the government to raise and support regular troops would compel us to depend upon the militia. He goes on and says, it would then be necessary to give this power to the government or run the risk of national annihilation. It is my firm belief that if a hostile attack were made this moment on the United States, it would flash conviction on the minds of the citizens of the United States of the necessity of vesting the government with this power, which alone can enable it to protect the community. And he's talking about the states. I do not wish to frighten the members into a concession of this power, but to bring to their minds those considerations which demonstrate its necessity. If we were secured from the possibility or probability of danger, it might be unnecessary. I shall not review the concourse of dangers which may probably arise at remote periods of futurity, nor all those which we have immediately to apprehend, for this would lead me beyond the bounds which I prescribe myself. But I will mention one single consideration drawn from fact itself, I hope to have your attention. By the treaty between the United States and His Most Christian Majesty, among other things, it is stipulated that the great principle on which the armed neutrality in Europe was founded should prevail in cases of future wars. The principle is this: that free ships shall make free goods, and the vessels and goods shall be both free from condemnation. Great Britain did not recognize it. While all Europe was against her, she held without acting on it. It has been considered for some time past that the flames of war already kindled would spread, and that France and England were likely to draw those swords which were so recently put up. And if you look at the history, he's absolutely right. This is judged probable. We should not be surprised in a short time to consider ourselves as a neutral nation, France on one side and Great Britain on the other. What is the situation of America? She is remote from Europe and ought not to engage in her politics or wars. The American vessels, if they can do it with advantage, may carry on the commerce of the contending nations. It is a source of wealth which we ought not to deny our citizens. But, sir, is there not an infinite danger that, in despite of all our caution, we shall be drawn into war? If American vessels have French property on board, Great Britain will seize them. By this means, we shall be obliged to relinquish the advantage of a neutral nation or to be engaged in war. A neutral nation ought to be respectable, or else it will be insulted and attacked. America, in her present impotent state or situation, would run the risk of being drawn in as a party in the war and lose the advantage of being neutral. And that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened. And as a matter of fact, I'll even go as far to say Britain never honored our treaty. We were in hostility from one point in time when Britain stopped actually engaging us militarily, where they finally re-engaged us in 1812. Anyway, going on, should it happen that the British fleet should be superior, have we not reason to conclude from the spirit displayed by that nation to us and to all the world that we should be insulted in our own ports and our vessels seized? But if we be in a respectable situation, if it be known that our government can command the whole resources of the Union, we shall be suffered to enjoy the great advantages of carrying on the commerce of the nations at war. For none of them would be willing to add us to the number of their enemies. I shall say no more on this point, there being others which merit your consideration. Then he goes on to address the other, four or five issues. Now, the whole point is that what Madison was talking about, and as a matter of fact, I believe Madison was president at the time when a ship was attacked by Britain in an American port, in a harbor. And so I'm here to tell you, my friends, that we were in a perpetual engagement with Britain, and Britain kept on ranking and ratcheting up its hostilities all the time, trying to strategically place troops into the west of us, as well as to the north, and actually project its navy so that it could descend upon us. Thus, the War of 1812 was inevitable, and I'm here to tell you that what ended up happening in light of that war was this interesting thing called the Treaty of Ghent, when we finally kicked their butt and they finally realized that they would never be able to, or at least they were convinced that it was not worth their effort to try to force us back under their Commonwealth. And so, as you probably know, the Treaty of Ghent was actually signed before the news of Andrew Jackson's butt-whooping, giving the British a good, run for their money and kick their butt down in the Mississippi area. And so the fact of the matter is that Britain, after they signed the Treaty of Ghent, even realized, shoot, these guys have even better forces than we even know or understand. That's why they just gave up. They finally acknowledged that they just couldn't project that force. They couldn't do it. We were beginning to become too big and starting to really arm ourselves with even greater weapons of war than a ragtag militia. We actually was building up a navy. We had Marines and so forth. And so we could actually project power. Therefore, the concept of the militia was successful because the militia was really what fought and won that war. And so let me move on to this next interesting comment by Madison. And this was regarding religion. Now remember, Nicholas has already kind of touched on religion and things that were not enumerated that the federal government could not meddle with these things. And this is what Mr. Madison says. The honorable member has introduced the subject of religion. Religion is not guarded. There is no Bill of Rights declaring that religion should be secure. Is a Bill of Rights a security for religion? Would the Bill of Rights in this state exempt the people from paying for the support of one particular sect if such sect were exclusively established by law? If there were a majority of the sect, a Bill of Rights would be a poor protection for liberty. Happily for the states, they enjoy the utmost freedom of religion. This freedom arises from the multiplicity of sects which pervades America and which is the best and only security for religion's liberty in any society. For where there is such a variety of sects, there cannot be a majority of any one sect to oppress and prosecute the rest. Fortunately for this Commonwealth, a majority of the people are decidedly against any exclusive establishment. I believe it to be so in other states. There is not a shadow of right in the general government to intermeddle with religion. Let me just repeat this, because this right here helps clarify, and you should start understanding that this is before the Bill of Rights even created that alleged protection of the of religion. There is not a shadow of right in the general government to intermeddle with religion. And as you can tell, based on that music, that we are coming into a break. But I'm glad I was able to resonate that one comment, that there is not a shadow of right in the general government to intermeddle with religion. And yet they still did it, even after the Bill of Rights. So we will be right back after these two promos to expound on what else Madison had to say. Thank you so much.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, so let's repeat that last sentence as we carry on for the final part of this paragraph. There is not a shadow of right in the general government to intermeddle with religion. Its least interference with it would be a most flagrant usurpation. In other words, even a minute, just a small, minuscule interference with it would be a most flagrant usurpation. I'll give you an example of a minute intermeddling or interference. And that minute interference would be removing prayer from the school, or removing reading the Bible from the school. Any kind of law, any kind of statute, anything that the federal government does in the name of religion would be a violation to the Constitution. Now, I've said this several times, but with that fact that they have no powers, and then on top of that, we actually created a Bill of Rights that said the federal government shall pass no law, which means that the Supreme Court can't make a ruling. And what do we have? We have them dictating godless secular religion in our education system and brainwashing everybody into heathenism and Satanism and godlessness. I'm not kidding. And as a matter of fact, the first person that I found in recent time that actually asserted this in print was Milton Friedman in his book Free to Choose. He goes on and says this. This is Madison. I can appeal to my uniform conduct on this subject that I have warmly supported religious freedom. It is better that this security should be depended upon the general legislature than from one particular state. A particular state might concur in one religious project. So in other words, now that they're constrained, that they have no power over this, then a state might be able to pick this up, but the federal government has no control, no power over what a state does. But the United States abound in such a variety of sects that it is a strong security against religious persecution, and it is sufficient to authorize a conclusion that not one sect will ever be able to outnumber or depress the rest. That's pretty profound. Anyway, this next comment, which is a very short one, and now we get into this little bantering back and forth between Clay, Madison, Mason, and so forth, and on and on and on. And so this is Mr. Clay saying he wished to be informed why the Congress were to have the power to provide for calling forth the militia to put the laws of the Union into execution. And Mr. Madison's response was, suppose the reasons of this power to be so obvious that they would occur to the most gentlemen. If resistance should be made to the execution of the laws, he said it ought to be overcome. This could be done only in two ways, either by regular forces or by the people. By one or the other, it must be unquestionably done. If insurrection should arise, and when he says regular forces, he's talking about the militia, the organized militia. If insurrection should arise or invasion should take place, the people ought unquestionably to be employed to suppress and repel them. In other words, what the heck's been going on our southern border? We should have been repelling them rather than a standing army. The best way to do these things was to put the militia on a good and sure footing and enable the government to use their services when necessary. Now, the most important thing I want to add to this is because Mason and others, the anti-federalists, were saying we need to put a clause in here to restrict the federal government from being able to call the militia. Fact of the matter is, my friends, there was never an amendment to restrict the federal government. Now, as Mason also, and I've read this already, had profoundly predicted how they would be able to bypass the militia unconstitutionally, and that's exactly what they did. But the fact of the matter is that the militia is the only constitutional process of executing the laws of the Union, repelling invasions, and dealing with insurrections. Mr. Chairman, I most cordially agree with the honorable member last up that a standing army is one of the greatest mischiefs that could possibly happen. It is a great recommendation for this system that it provides against this evil more than any other system known to us, and particularly more than the old system of the Confederation. The most effectual way to guard against a standing army is to render it unnecessary. Did you hear that? The most effectual way to guard against a standing army is to render it unnecessary. The most effectual way to render it unnecessary is to give the general government full power to call forth the militia and exert the whole natural strength of the Union when necessary. Did you hear that? I mean, what he's saying is that this is the recipe, this is what you have to do, and this is all you can do. This is how we keep from having regular troops and they never amended the Constitution to change that. So this is how it's supposed to be done, my friends, per the contract. These are legally binding statements that say this is what the federal government has to do. Now, the federal government has been ignoring the contract because they have enjoyed their ability to buy off states and unconstitutionally aggrandize their positions and their power. Anyway, Madison goes on and says this, "Thus, you will furnish the people with sure and certain protection without recurring to this evil, and the certainty of this protection from the whole will be a strong inducement in individual exertion. Does the organization of the government warrant a belief that this power can be abused or will be abused? Can we believe that a government of a federal nature, not a federal government, but a federal nature, coexisting of many co-equal sovereignties, you hear that? Co-equal sovereignties, consisting of the co-equal sovereignties, and particularly having one branch chosen from the people." So what I'm doing while I'm talking, so forgive me for getting distracted right there. I just want you to know, what I'm doing is I'm actually highlighting, bolding, and enlarging this text so that if you want to see this, let me know, and we will actually start posting all. Then this is posted out on MobiusStripPress.com. Most all of these extracts or these parts of these ratification debates are actually available for you to read in other locations as well. You can download this whole thing, and I give you the links to where you can go to the Constitution Society and pull these things in. What I am doing is I'm highlighting and enlarging the text of these things that are so important in laying waste and putting down and actually destroying the argument that we constantly hear by either sovereign citizens, by progressives, and others. As a matter of fact, I'm going on a tangent. I've engaged with a person that completely ignores the fact that the Constitution is a compact and that the Constitution was clearly defined. As a matter of fact, this person completely accepts the living document concept, and he calls himself a patriot. And I'm just aghast at thinking that this person is, you know, out there, and there's other people like this out there that think that they're really conservative and patriotic when they're not supporting the Constitution. We are not to support a president. We're not to support the federal government. We are not to support anything but this Constitution. Thus, the citizen's oath, as well as the oaths of offices, all types of service, are to support the Constitution and defend it against enemies, foreign and domestic. That domestic enemy can be and is the general government. So going back to what Madison was saying, and particularly having one branch chosen from the people would drag the militia unnecessarily to immense distances. This, sir, would be unworthy the most arbitrary despot. They have no temptation whatsoever to abuse this power. Such abuse could only answer the purpose of exciting the universal indignation of the people and drawing on themselves and general hatred and detestation of their country. I cannot help thinking that the honorable gentleman has not considered in all its consequences the amendment he has proposed. He's talking about Mason. Would this be an equal protection, sir? Or would it not be a most partial provision? Some states have 3 or 4 states in contact. Were this state invaded as it is bounded by several states, the militia of 3 or 4 states would, by this proposition, be obliged to come to our aid. And those, we're at that break time, so I'm going to pick this back up. Were this state invaded? Because he wants to put this into context for Mason to understand that these neighboring states are obliged to helping each other. Now, with that, we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Are you a patriotic proprietor of a business that is looking to get exposure on a fast-growing program? How would you like to get exposure on the only program on the air that provides an actual constitutional solution to all the federal government overreach and encroachments? If you understand the importance of educating the electorate, we would love to work with you in growing your business and revenues while you support the airing of our content on this station. Your support goes to growing the reach of this show and does not pay for elaborate salaries or highfalutin lifestyles. The show is growing fast, and we're also planning on airing the content about Republic Review on a video medium soon. If you'd like to be a part of history and the growth of the most relevant and result-oriented show on the air anywhere in the world, then just email me at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can lock in exceptional pricing and great advertising opportunities. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so Madison is painting this picture regarding Mason's amendment. Mason wanted to make it impossible for a state that's not on the border of a state being invaded, that they cannot traverse a state to get to that state. In other words, the states in the Union would then, based on this amendment, be dependent upon the local states only, and if they can't, they would need the state government to acknowledge and allow their militia in the service of the United States to be able to go to that state. Now, in context to what Mason's amendment was, when the Civil War came up and they created the boundaries for the South and said, we are the Southern Confederate States, we have seceded and we are no longer a part of the Union. What that would have meant is that only those states that had this amendment been considered and passed, only the states along that border could have been the ones that could have gotten involved. And it would have required the federal government to then actually create a standing army, but they would have had to amend the Constitution to do so. But instead, that amendment was never created in allowing or restricting states from keeping their militia because it's a greater than a state away. So my point is that with the fact that this amendment was never written and ratified, the fact is that the general government had the power and the authority to call forth the militia to engage in the insurrection and rebellion against the Constitution, which is what the South was doing. It never authorized the general government to create a standing army in replace of the militia. The only way they could have created a standing army instead of a militia was in doing a constitutional amendment. Now, here's the point. They had all these northern states. I want you to understand this. All the northern states could have easily amended the Constitution like they did with the 13th and 14th Amendment. After the South had seceded, they could have easily amended the Constitution and would have had the authority to create the standing army. Why didn't they? Because the states weren't going to allow them to change the terms of the contract to relying upon the militia. So the general government had to turn its back on the Constitution and the states and actually form a standing army. All unconstitutional. Now back to what Madison is saying regarding this proposed amendment by George Mason. Were the state invaded, Virginia, as it is bounded by several states, the militia of three or four states would, by this proposition, be obliged to come to our aid, and those from some of the states would come a far greater distance than those others. There are other states which, if invaded, could be assisted by the militia of only one state, there being several states which border but one state. Georgia and New Hampshire would be definitely less safe than the other states were we to adopt this amendment. We should set up those states as butts for our invasion, invite foreign enemies to attack them, and expose them particular hardships and dangers. Were the militia confined to any limited distance from their respective place of abode, it would produce equal, nay, more inconveniences. The principles of equality and reciprocal aid would be destroyed in either case. I cannot conceive that this Constitution, by giving the general government the power of arming the militia, takes it away from the state governments. The power is concurrent and not exclusive. Have we not found from experience that while the power of arming and governing the militia has been solely vested in the state legislatures, they were neglected and rendered unfit for immediate service? Every state neglected too much this most essential object, but the general government can do it more effectually. Have we not also found that the militia of one state were almost always insufficient to secure its harassed neighbor? Did all the states furnish their quotas of militia with sufficient promptitude? The assistance of one state will be of little avail to repel invasion, but the general head of the whole Union can do it with the effect if it be vested with the power to use the aggregate strength of the Union. If the regulation of the militia were to be committed by the executive authority alone, there might be reason for providing restrictions. But, sir, it is the legislative authority that has this power. They must make a law for the purpose. In other words, like I just said, they have to make an amendment. They have to actually create the law if they are not going to use the militia. It's pretty simple. At least to me, it's an open and shut case. Now, Mr. Clay then responds to Mr. Madison and says, "By this power, our militia might be sent to the Mississippi River." He observed that the sheriff might raise the posse comitatus. Now, I want you to understand something. The posse comitatus was something that was referred to and actually injected, supposedly, was actually injected into our legal system during the Civil War. You know, that this is where they supposedly said, okay, we cannot use the military against civilian people. Posse comitatus has been a standing law of nations, and it has been a part of our government. And here he even raises this. The sheriff might raise the posse comitatus to execute the laws. He feared, now this is Mr. Clay saying, he feared it would lead to the establishment of a military government as the militia were to be called forth to put the laws into execution. He asked why this mode was preferred to the old established custom of executing the laws. Madison answered this way. He said, the power existed in all countries that the militia might be called forth that for that purpose under the laws of this state and every other state in the Union, that public force must be used when resistance to the laws required it. Otherwise, society must be destroyed that the most referred by to by the gentleman might not be sufficient to every occasion, as the sheriff must be necessarily restricted to the posse of his own county. The posse of one county were insufficient to overcome the resistance of the execution of laws. This power must be restored to. He did not by any means admit that the mode was superseded by the introduction of the new one, and it was obvious to him that the civil power was sufficient. This mode would never be practiced. And so this is just gold right here. I'm just telling you that when you start reading the ratification debates, it just starts to become very, very clear. Now, we've got a long, quite a few paragraphs here. So I'm just going to start chunking away because this is Mr. Nicholas talking about the militia. And he says, Mr. Chairman, the great object of government in every country is security and public defense. I suppose, therefore, that we ought to attend to here is what is the best mode of enabling the general government to protect us. One of three ways must be pursued for this purpose. We must either empower them to employ and rely altogether on a standing army via the Constitution, or depend altogether on militia. Or else we must enable them to use one or the other of these two ways as may be found most expedient. Do you get that? In other words, the Constitution didn't give them the way to do both. That it was incumbent on the federal government to use the militia alone. The least reflection will satisfy us that the convention has adopted the only proper method. You get that? In other words, the only proper method is via the militia. If a standing army were alone to be employed, such an army must be kept in the time of peace as would be sufficient in war. The dangers of such an army are so striking that every man would oppose the adoption of government had it been proposed by it as the only mode of defense. Would it be safe to depend on the militia alone without the agency, regular forces, even in the time of war? Were we to invade a powerful, disciplined army, should we be safe in the militia? Could men unacquainted with the hardships and unskilled of the discipline of war, men only inure and train themselves to the peaceable occupations of domestic life, encounter with success the most skillful veterans inured to the fatigues and toils of campaigns. Although some people are pleased with the theory of reliance on the militia as the sole defense of a nation, yet I think it to be found in practice to be by no means adequate. And so anyway, he goes on. What I really wanted to point out was some other things, but we ran out of time. We will pick this up where we've left off in our next episode. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show
in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobius Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobius Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.